Welcome to the Education Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Here in our PCRF Journal Club, we promote evidence-based practices by critically evaluating the latest science in emergency medical services. We hope our discussion will help advance EMS practice. Through the generous support of our sponsor, Limmer Education, we can make science more accessible and understandable.
My microphone wasn't working. There we go. Hello and welcome to the February 2026 Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Education Research Journal Club. The PCRF, as you know, we promote research literacy to advance the science of EMS educational research and clinical practice. So here with the PCRF Journal Club, we take a closer look at some of the latest research happening in medical education. Thank you to Limmer Education for sponsoring these podcasts so we can bring you the best of science in education. I'm Megan Corey. I am here with Dr. Bill Toon. And guess what? We have a whole panel of authors with us. So this is really exciting. This study is really exciting. We're so happy you came to join us. And remember that if you ever miss out on our and you have to leave early or you've missed out on past ones, you can go to our YouTube channel and you can find our past journal clubs. You can look us up at PCRF at UCLA or just search PCRF journal clubs and find both the clinical and the education research monthly recordings. I was so excited. I forgot to even announce the study we're even going to look at. But we're going to be discussing this article. It's published. It's open access. You can pull it up. Neurology Education is the journal, and it's entitled Curriculum Innovation, Training the Frontline, a Neurologic Emergencies Curriculum Pilot for First Responders. And like I said, we have the whole panel of authors here with us who are going to discuss their research with us and help us guide us through, you know, the entire research in like a little bit less than an hour. So we're going to just get started. And just a reminder, you can put your questions in the chat. Please, listeners, you can use the chat feature on your screen, type in questions and comments, and we can bring those in as we go. We can ask the authors all of the questions about how they implemented this and all those things that you educators and budding researchers are thinking about now. So let's move a little bit forward. I'm going to actually pull up and let me just go back and not to be distracting, pull up the authors here. We've got Dr. Amanda Hagulino Cole, that who was the first person I had emailed. This is the person who was the contact on the article and immediately responded, said, we will be there. So thank you for coming and congratulations on this research. If you could begin by introducing yourself, that'd be great. And then I'll bring in the others.
Okay. Yeah. And I know this is a fast moving journal club, so I don't want to take too much time, but I definitely want to thank you all. It's an honor to present our paper, or I guess talk about our paper with you all. Learning about your organization, it's really cool to have something that's dedicated on supporting for pre-hospital care and pre-hospital education, interprofessional education. So I'm Amanda Hagulino Cole. I'm a associate professor in neurology at McGovern Medical School, UT Health at Houston. I am super excited about this project. It was a lot of, I think in a good way, blood, sweat, and tears from the team. And I'm glad we have representation from our EMS clinicians and leadership with Chief Martin and our research coordinator and other physicians who worked on this. And I think we might have a stroke coordinator hopefully joining us soon. But yeah, thank you so much for this. Appreciate it.
Great. So we have the primary author, Tamia Garrett, who is research coordinator, correct?
Yes, that's correct. I'm a research coordinator at UT Health at Houston at McGovern, working directly with Dr. Hagulino.
So do you work for the department then, for neurology department?
Yes,
neurology?
For the neurology department, yes.
Great. Well, congratulations on your primary authorship and on this amazing research. And then we have a few people here that I see have joined us also from University of Texas Health Science Center, McGovern Medical School. And that is, let's see, Dr. Chandra, you are from, yes.
Also from the UT Houston team, I'm a neurologist and a neurohospitalist over with the UT Health Houston team, and so excited to be here today. Thank you for having us.
Great, thank you. And I'm sorry, I'm gonna like
It's
butcher
okay.
these
It's
names.
Shantha
Thank you. You knew exactly who I was talking about.
Yeah,
Come on
no,
in.
So I'm an assistant professor of neurology at UT Houston as well. I'm a vascular neurologist and neurohospitalist and a telestroke neurologist as well. So I really enjoyed being part of this research study. We got a chance to interact with the EMS, paramedics. I mean, it was a very great interaction, and yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing more about it. Dr. Mudassani?
Hello, everyone. I'm Varsha Mudassani. I'm one of the fellows here, and I'm doing my 1 year vascular fellowship at UT. Thank you for this invitation and excited to be a part of this.
Great. And is it Mahan Sharivari?
Yes, I don't know if my mic is mute or not. Can you hear
No,
me?
you're good. We can hear you.
Oh, perfect. Hi, this is Mahan Charivari. I'm one of the vascular neurologists here at UT. And thank you very much for your invitation today. And I'm very excited and happy to be a part of this team for this manuscript.
Great. And if I have my count correct on the authors, I went through the authors and looked at your affiliations. We had three authors who are from the Victoria Fire Department, Brandy Davis, Mark Martin, who's here. Mark Martin is here, and Dana Woodward. And I think, Mark, you are the representative here from the Victoria Fire Department.
Yes, ma'am. I was working at Victoria Fire Department at the time of the study, and I'm currently in Sugar Land, but yes, ma'am, I was part of that.
And what's your role?
In Victoria, at the start of the study, I was the EMS battalion chief. Currently, I'm the EMS division chief in Sugar Land.
Great. And are you is your role training in the fire department?
It butts against training at certain items. So for EMS training, I had input on it. But Brandy Davis and Chief Woodward were the training cadre. They were
Mm-hmm.
both attached to the training division. They ran the
Great.
majority of all training needs in Victoria.
Okay, great. And then the other person that is the other author that I could see listed here, unless I forgot anybody, is from Citizens Medical Center, Victoria, Texas. That's Krista Autry. And I don't see Krista on, but that's again an interprofessional team. So let me just start by asking, and let me bring in Amanda, if you can talk to us a little bit about how this all started. How did you even come up with, and I'm going to put up the research kind of objective here. You wanted to create this interactive, needs-based. Now, I thought that was an important word here. You talked about needs-based training program that was interactive, that was used active learning, experiential learning, simulation, case-based kind of techniques to see if there was, an impact on several things. And one of the things I do wanted to bring up to the audience who we do a little bit of research teaching here. And the Kirkpatrick model of evaluating an educate the impact of an education program, we've talked about a little bit on this journal club, but this is a great article to go back to, and they really tease out these Kirkpatrick levels of evaluating an education curriculum. So it's a good piece of education research here too. So if you could just walk us through where it even came from.
Sure. I think it was kind of multifaceted, and everyone else on the team, please feel free to interject at any time. But I think all of us worked in some degree in this. It was a great city, Victoria, but neurologically underserved. And most cities are neurologically underserved. But at the same time, it was a city where there were. It is a city where there are a lot of people who really just want to do what's right for the patient, improve our care, and really work together. And so it was really helpful that we had contacts with the EMS team. With one of our, there is a primary stroke center there as well. And we had physicians who do at least beam in to take care of patients in Victoria via telestroke and teleneurology. But also we tend to drive there. That's about 2 hours away from Houston. So just sort of collaborating, well, it could be logistically a challenge, but it's such a joy to like go there and meet people. And so I think it was just sort of everyone wanting to provide the best care possible, help the first responders feel comfortable with at least the initial assessment of neurologic patient care. And so it kind of just stemmed from, I think, everyone's interest in wanting to be better and do better for patients and for the clinicians.
And you use the term several times in here of neurologically underserved setting. Can you describe what that means?
Oh, that's a great question. So there's a shortage of neurologists, and especially for emergent care where someone has to be available 24/7, which is, the patient population that the first responders, EMS clinicians take care of. And so there's just a shortage nationwide, which is actually why we do have things like telestroke, not to focus too much on the telestroke part, but we do have things like telestroke and teleneurology to be able to provide emergent care or inpatient acute care 24/7 for patients who don't have a neurologist in town.
Okay, thank you. So, and when you decided maybe EMS would be the appropriate, target to improve care, how did you, pick you're located in Victoria? Well, actually, that you're not located, you're in Houston, Texas. How did you, find Victoria Fire Department?
Oh, sure. So we collaborate in patient care with one of the local hospitals, Citizens Medical Center, and so we see, we beam in through telestroke, which is again probably a separate topic, but we beam in and we take care of patients. But often the paramedics are there in the ER as they're, obviously they have to move on to the next case, but providing history, giving whatever they found on the scene, and so that interaction kind of grew into how can we kind of interact more, and they, not to generalize, but they were always very curious about, okay, what do we think this is? What's going on with their exam, and also what are the next steps? I think one of the problems that we have that we chat that one of the challenges in interprofessional education is we all have our silos, and so I think there was a curiosity that I could at least detect, and Chief Martin may be able to kind of describe that in a different way, but I could de detect a curiosity among the people that we did interact with, and then I would say because there is and was great leadership in Victoria Fire Department, as well as at this primary stroke center. And then we were, excited to kind of get engaged with new learners and so on, that I think that sort of just was like perfect storm. So.
Yeah, great. Was anyone on the team already familiar with training with EMS and training with the fire service?
Yeah, actually, I think Dr. Rohrer has done some work with that in the
Yeah,
past.
so I before joining UT Houston, I was a neurohospitalist at a comprehensive stroke center, but we covered quite a bit of regions and neurologically underserved regions. But we worked with EMS and kind of taught some of the stroke triage protocols, and so I've had a prior experience with EMS. I've done a few research projects as well with them.
Yeah, and this will come up when we talk about like how you did this, because this was and same if we can bring you and Mark in about this discussion. So we're going to dig into like some of your figures, and one of your first figures shows all of this. But let me just start with the objective. When going back to the research question, if when you were looking at we want to test an impact of a curriculum on, did they their reaction. Their learning experience, which is Kirkpatrick level one. We see lots of that, but we know we want to get out there at the real question is, does it impact patients? And then the short-term knowledge, so testing at each step, which is the Kirkpatrick level two. Three would be evaluating their behaviors, right? If did they actually implement something, which is hard to do if you're not teaching an actual procedural skill or a stroke scale or whatever. And then the ultimate here is. And actually, I guess you could even take it a step further and say there's a fifth level, the community, but the clinical outcomes themselves. And you looked at things like, thrombectomy and thrombosis and door to needle time transfers for treatment for patients with thrombosis treatment and thrombectomy treatment, and then door to needle time as those clinical outcomes. Which of course we know it gets difficult with all the different variables, and we'll talk about that. So that's actually kind of the whole thing. And then there were learner objectives. Tell me about the education. When you got to say we want to develop a curriculum, that was a lot of there was a looks like there was a lot of detail in this. And how did you do that interprofessionally? Develop like what can we do, and what should we do to implement a training curriculum?
For us, I think everyone kind of had a different perspective to add. So it was, I think one of the, and if I can say, strengths of our project was that it was interprofessionally developed. So we had a nurse stroke coordinator, we had EMS leadership, we had stroke and neurology physicians, and we were just kind of trying to think, what is important to know to help patients. For those who are not familiar, and I think everyone would be in this setting, stroke is very time sensitive, and time is brain. And every minute, it was that 2 billion neurons die. So it's very time sensitive. So emphasizing the things that are important to in recognition was important of stroke symptoms and anything neurologic too. We didn't just do stroke, but it was just sort of the thing that had the easiest metrics to kind of measure because we already had things in place like door to needle time and identification for thrombectomy, things like that. And so a recognition wasn't very important for us. And also time sensitivity, not that anyone's, twiddling their thumbs in the field, but just knowing that, okay, we have to take this patient to a stroke center or a neuro center immediately. And then any kind of potential care that can be given in the pre-hospital setting. So that was very important. And then also knowing what the next steps are. So for example, one of the things for those who aren't not neuro is, for example, with this clot busting medication, thrombolysis, and there's certain criteria and to give it and certain criteria to not give it. And that's a whole, level of training that neurologists go through. And especially when they go into a fellowship, in addition to neuro training in stroke care, you really get to know that like the back of your hand. But it's important to know things really quickly. Like, just for example, is someone on a really strong blood thinner? Because if they are, we might not be able to give the medication depending on the situation. So having some of the important history is important. Knowing the medications, the last known well is also very important for us because there are certain time windows that come with giving thrombolysis or identifying for thrombectomy. And I think there's not a uniform way that I know of that all of the levels of care up through ER presentation and management are kind of universal. So I don't I know that there is currently neuro training, stroke training for EMS providers and clinicians, but it may not include all of these details. And so just sort of bringing those up as an example from the stroke world, at least, was a big objective for us from the stroke center perspective, from EMS perspective, and from the neurology perspective.
Can you walk me through how you developed? So you have this multifaceted curriculum, a multimodal curriculum. First, the topics. You had the four kind of main bucket areas that included ischemic stroke, TIA, and intracranial hemorrhage. So all in the stroke realm. Then number two was TBI and headache in one realm, and then number three was seizure, syncope, dizziness, encephalopathy, and confusion. And then you later note that, seizure and stroke are probably just coming from the paramedic perspective. Those are the two that seem to have the most, consistent education ever since, the approval of TPA for stroke, and ever since the couple of big randomized controlled trials on seizures and now in pediatric seizures for pre-hospital. So those are definitely on our radar for training. You mentioned later lumping, encephalopathy in with that may have kind of muddied the waters of your assessment. But and then the number four was spinal cord neuromuscular injuries too. So how did you decide on those four buckets of topics?
That's a great question. Well, we had a little bit of guidance. There is a book, and I'm so sorry, I should have it with me, but it's
Oh
a
yeah, the pre-hospital
yeah,
neurological
a, yeah,
references.
exactly that one. I'm sorry, I can send it out or if it helps, but
Yeah.
it is mentioned in the paper. That was our I guess step one that we kind of was easy to find the book, look at it, think about it. But then kind of lumping things together, we actually had a different curriculum structure before we did the needs assessment. So we were going to do this all virtual and have like a different topic every month. We from our learner assessment, our needs assessment, the EMS clinicians mentioned that they prefer in-person care as much as possible. So we're fortunate that we're only 2 hours away. We had to pivot if needed for weather, we get hurricanes in Southeast Texas a lot, for example. But we decided, since that was what the learners were telling us, that we would do it in person as much as possible. But then it was hard to go every month. So basically we clumped things together, and I hate to say it that way, but that is what we did, based on kind of the topic, and being able to fit it into a case. So we had case-based learning, and we decided and developed the cases, because for EMS clinicians, it's things are undifferentiated. They don't have a CT scan saying, hey, there's a hemorrhage. They don't have an MRI saying this is a stroke, not a seizure. Kind of making the fitting the cases so they made sense, to kind of walk the learners through the case and think about it critically, like what could this be, and what, could the next steps be, what information do we need to collect. And so we initially had a different curriculum structure, but this was restructured based on the needs assessment, and also based on feedback from Chief Martin, in terms of, learning styles, their experiences with their education locally, and their experiences with their, what are the first responders doing in the field? So that's kind of how we came to the landed on those topics. In a perfect world, we would have had a longer curriculum period and kind of spread things out. But I think you learn as you go, and so that's kind of where we were at this point. I think, every curriculum has a different iteration the next time. So this can be restructured.
Yeah, great. So Chief Martin, you were mentioned here. What was your role in this initially, and how did you feedback it, between, how did you act as a go-between for the EMS providers? The pragmatic part of this, right? The practical part. How do we get this going when they're
So
working?
how it kind of came to be on our side is the medical director for Victoria Fire Department is the ER director for Citizens Medical Center. So he worked very closely with Christy Autry and Dr. Hagelina on a normal basis. And he reached out with this idea of a study that was given by Christy and by Dr. Hagelino and see if we'd want to be able to participate in it. Now, it's generally pretty hard to get good quality in-person EMS training, especially if you have a smaller department or a department that's strapped on money. A lot of places do an online portal and we go from there. So when it was presented that we could have a neurological team come down and perform or at least a couple of in-person sessions, and then with the rest being online based, but still tailored to what we're looking at, we really jumped on the opportunity for that.
Yeah, we're talking about 120 miles away from Houston, right? You folks are t about 120 miles away from each other, so it's not like you could just hop in and Uber and and go out
In
there,
traffic
right?
on the Houston area, 120 miles can get to be a couple hours if you're just lucky on the way of things. But
So, how did you how what's the size of the department, the Victoria Fire Department?
so the Victoria Fire Department's around 130 members, with about 115 to 120 of those in operations. So there's at the time there was three shifts that worked 48 hours and then worked 96 hours off. So the training as it was delivered, once we settled on a in-person training for the majority of it, was Dr. Hagelino or her team would have to come in essentially three times a week to hit every shift, because we were trying to train everyone. We didn't have the ability to pay overtime to have that many people come in off duty, and we knew we wouldn't get the buy-in. People like in-person training, but they like their time off a whole lot more. So to hit as many people as we could get, we decided to hold these on shift, which is very difficult for us to do. And I think it kind of came out in the paper and the study later on that one of the major hurdles was just trying to deliver in-person training on shift base while those crews are still having to respond to emergencies. And it can be pretty difficult sometimes. I know I felt bad personally because I felt like I was wasting Dr. Hagelino's time, because we'd show up to a class and out of the projected 15 people, I'd have maybe three or six. So it was definitely a big hurdle on that part.
Yeah, I do think it was great though that you did this practical approach. This is a realistic thing that we encounter. You're either going to come up with money for, paying people to be still and in one spot, or we're going to be realistic and say, how do we do this training while people are moving? And that's a challenge. I'm sure that you all have faced this in hospital as well. How do you do, training in the emergency department as well? I don't know if, that if any of the others who have participated, Dr. Manasani, Sharivari, did you pr participate with and Tamia, who's, I'm sorry, am I, like, there's so many of you, I can't see you all. If you participated in the actual hands-on with the EMS crews?
So we rotated among the neurologists. So Dr. Aurora taught a few lectures. Dr. Chandra, I think she's still on. I know she's, I think she had a commitment. So she's still on. Okay. Dr. Chandra did as well. We also had people, for example, for something like spinal cord, which I'm not, personally as a vascular neurologist, I'm not quite as comfortable with that. So we definitely reached out to our neuro ICU colleagues. So we had, not just people from this team, but we had people rotating when they could to give lectures. So I think, one of the hurdles, which I think we overcame, it was not easy, but I think everyone really wanted to make it work, was scheduling at a time when EMS didn't have, something else besides their normal workday going on, because they also have a lot of events and programs and stuff, at a time when the physician was also off, and also when when we could provide a space, whether that was at Victoria Fire Department or in the local hospital to teach. So that was an obstacle, but I think we overcame it. It was just a lot of communication and being as flexible as we could. So doctor, I don't know if you wanted to talk about your experiences teaching, doctor.
So I think I recall doing two sessions. And so, but yeah, no, I think it was a pleasant experience. First of all, you get to interact with them directly, which you don't get to do when we're usually on the other end of it, right? So we're usually provide telestroke. So it's nice to actually see and have interaction with the paramedics who are getting the history and in the early part of the stroke code. So I think that was it was a good experience, and it's the in I enjoy the in-person part of it actually. So and I think there is a value. I know we do a lot of these virtually for convenience, but I think there's it's worth it, and it's not too bad of a drive. It's about a 2-hour drive, which is not bad,
We'd like to transport you here. Okay, so and that's actually a great point too. So we hear a lot of feedback from the field that we really would like more education. We need more in-depth education, feedback about our patient care, that kind of thing. And you've cited a few studies in this article too about, the impact of that and the desire for more education. And here we have it, and then the logistics come in, right? And that's what always gets in the way. I love that this is longitudinal. So you came up with this plan for having, and this, I don't know who's responsible for this beautiful infographic, but it's just it's a great way of illustrating that you had the session itself, which is in red here, the topic underneath it, the assessment tool that you used, the timeline itself, and then the course development and the post-curriculum course evaluation at certain areas. So this really helps illustrate this. Also, people that are listening should know that there is supplemental material that gives you the details on the key points in some of the training sessions, which again allows us to, as educators and maybe education researchers, to pick this up and say, could we, kind of mimic this somewhere in here? Do any of the others have comments about the training aspects and your role in the training aspects? Dr. Chandra, you were mentioned in your spinal cord.
No, so just to kind of similar but not the same experience, I work with our local EMS at one of our medically underserved hospitals in the Harris County area. And speaking of practical simulations and the impact of practical kind of the practicality of everybody's schedules and patient care always being a priority. For our EMS simulations, if there is an actual case going on for which we have to exit, one of my colleagues has come up with a safe word, which is pineapple, which means the simulation ends and we got to go work on the patient later on. So I think that's just a thing of making these bedside pearls very easy to kind of take. And even for the cases that we did for this kind of case-based curriculum, I'm a very case-based learner. Honestly, as neurologists, sometimes I know we all tend to pontificate and we can go on and on about studies and data all the time. But what I really enjoyed was from getting insights from clinicians at across this, like from pre-hospital to the hospital setting. And you could really see that as we were doing these case-based discussions, you know, we talked about like, okay, have you seen a hemorrhagic stroke? And how did you know whether it was a hemorrhage or not? And like, you know, the paramedics like knew, like they were like, we saw this, we saw this. And so you can see the experience really kind of, you know, that those cases stand out to them, and hats off to them, because as first responders, neurology is one of the many, many, many calls they take. So I think for me, that was a really kind of amazing way to translate what we do all day, every day, but they do one of the many, many things on their day-to-day basis is neurology. So I think I really enjoyed that aspect.
Yeah, I think that was great that you included things like encephalopathy. I mean, altered mental status alone is a challenging presentation and multifaceted. So we always say that by the time it gets to the neurologist, there's something of an answer there. So I love that you included differential diagnosis as well. Chief Martin, did you have any issues with buy-in?
At first, I mean, Victoria is a fairly busy service. There's only five ambulances that cover about 100,000 people in a 900 square mile area, so we're busy. And so whenever you're asking somebody to go and do more than what they typically would, even when we're already as busy as we are, and we add in extracurricular events, public outreach events, and then in training on top of it, it does get hard. And when you ask the other available ambulances to pick up the slack while somebody's off, there is agitation. I'm not gonna lie, it's always a hurdle in training. Once people got involved in the training after the first couple of sessions, and we saw what we were learning and how we were learning it, because it is very much focused on the different types of strokes, but the way Dr. Cole and the team presented it was that, hey, this looks like a stroke. Here's how it looks like a stroke, but this is not a stroke. You need to be aware of these metrics. So it was a lot of ways to differentiate types of neurological emergencies that aren't typically presented a whole lot in classical CE, at least not in Texas, in my experience. So it was nice to have that. I think especially with the more involved members that love EMS more than your average medic. The ability for those people specifically, the high performers, to get that extra bit of training. Some of them had incredible buy-in. And even people that I would not have typically thought would be happy about participating in this kind of training or just in extra training period, the level that some of them got involved was appreciative. Like it was good. It was a very good program for it. And overall, I would say we had a lot of buy-in as a system for it.
It's great testament to the team for staying with it, because sometimes it can get frustrating if you feel like, well, it's got a slow start and maybe there's not as much buy-in. And as you go along, and as people start to realize, wow, I'm part of something bigger, and this is actually really important for patients. And you know, look at all these neurologists here who care, and these researchers and everything. I think it becomes like I can't sit in my ambulance and complain about not getting education when I've got this team of people here that care. So,
So that was a big part of the buy-in is normally if you're going to get in-person CE, it would be somebody like myself or Brandy Davis or Chief Woodward, you know, somebody who is just a paramedic, and I won't say just a paramedic, but just a paramedic in the department, that we have the exact same experience, we have the same basic knowledge, we have the same basic experiences. And that's one thing if I go in and teach and we all get a few CE hours out of it. But when you bring in experts in their field, like people who do this for a living that are much, much highly qualified or much more highly qualified than what I would be or what Chief Woodward would be or what Brandy would be, that alone lends a whole lot of credibility to the process, and that gets people to pay more attention. Just that level of, I guess, authority in that subject matter really, really helps for the buy-in.
Great. So let's talk about some of these tables of results. So, and actually, I don't want to jump over all of the, I think you've covered exactly what, you know, was what topics were covered, but how it was delivered, I thought was really unique too. So you had this introductory session, where the neurologist guided the large group in performing an exam. You divided them into smaller groups to practice the neurologic exam. And then you had these, so those were interactive learning sessions that were delivered longitudinally. And you talked about starting with an icebreaker. Can you tell me what that meant to the icebreaker or an icebreaker quiz? Do you remember
Yes,
that?
sure. And I definitely want to hear what other people have to say as well. But it was just I think you have people who are coming into an enclosed space, who have come in not only from different training perspectives, different styles of training, different professions, but also from we had these EMS clinicians who were just coming in maybe just after saving a life, or telestroke, people were just covering service the other week or so. So everyone's kind of coming in with this noise in their head, and so it was kind of I thought it was a fun way to kind of just get everyone on the same page. Question Just simple questions like I think what was the one? It's like what year would you travel to if you could travel to any year? And it was interesting responses across the board. So that was kind of our perspective. I don't know if anyone made any comments from the EMS side, but
Not that I recall. I do remember that question, though. I don't remember
I
the answer to it, but I
don't
remember
remember my answer
the
either.
answer.
That's great. I'm always curious about what people use, to do. Are they basic icebreakers or something, different? So we have at that in the previous slide, you had seen that there was the whole timeline, but there was at a midpoint of the curriculum, the large group learning and assessment session, and that had simulated patient encounters that targeted the differential diagnoses that were taught in the course. So what we're seeing right now, the first kind of bit of results, this figure two that looks at the self-reported familiarity, this was done before and after each. This is the paramedic saying, "I'm how familiar was I, before the course?" They do that before the entire thing and then after, right? Was it after each section?
Yeah, so we had the set of different sessions. So for example, as Steve Martin mentioned, that there was one session where like three people, but then the next session would have 15. So for each session we had a pre post. So it was a very immediate learning, but it was probably the best way to kind of capture that information. But it was after each session. And then we also had one after the before and after the simulation session.
And for research, budding kind of researchers out there, and one of the things we do know, and we've reviewed this on this journal club before, st studies have to go beyond that because sometimes what people feel, I feel more confident, doesn't translate into how they perform, right? Or what they feel they're comfortable with doesn't necessarily translate later. So that's why the later, but this is a great first step. You want to know how they feel. How familiar do they feel with it before and after? And the one that of course stands out is the after, the encephalopathy before the course and encephalopathy after the course, which doesn't surprise me because encephalopathy is a broad topic that isn't well covered in at least in the initial training of paramedics. Anything else, anything surprise you about it? Actually, both in neurology and EMS, anything surprise you about like what people said about their familiarity with the topics?
At first, when I first saw this graph, and I was surprised that I thought that there would have been a bigger trend towards I understand more in it. After I sat and kind of just thought about it, I was happy with how the graph ended up portraying the numbers and the percentages. Because to me, it's like, hey, I thought I knew a lot, but then after having taken this course, I know more than I did. But now I'm not near as confident in the amount of knowledge that I had before, and I realize there's a lot more that I need to do to learn about those topics.
Anybody else? Okay, so
Obviously,
then,
our
oh,
oh,
sorry,
sorry,
go ahead. No, go ahead.
our objective was we were hoping it would be more of a greater. I agree with what Chief Martin. But at the same time, I think this was useful information. I think it's authentic information, and it kind of gives us a sense. Okay, at least people are some. There's nobody who's not familiar anymore. Thank goodness. That would be bad. But also that we have more work to do. With the next iteration.
Yeah, and there's also little details like what did they mean by familiarity?
That's
Yeah,
true.
I'm familiar with it. But then if people go treat patients, do they feel like it had an impact? That kind of thing would be interesting to follow too. So tell
And
me about this one. This is the actual testing, the pre-test, pre-treatment, pre-education program assessment, and then post-test. after the program.
This was more exciting for us, and I do need to make sure we give a shout out to Mia Garrett, who made many of these
Yes.
figures. Dr. Mudassani made the curriculum layout figure that you mentioned just recent or just a couple
Yeah,
slides
that's a
ago.
beautiful thing.
So thank you to the team, and Dr. Charivari also
Yes.
made some figures with her analysis. Yeah, but we were more excited that at least, and it was a knowledge test, so it's not, it's like a, level two. It's not, and I think that was something that we, would love to assess in the future as a third level learning by maybe actually just saying, hey, did they do all the parts of the neuro exam, things like that. But I think this was also meaningful in the sense that, we were able to, they were able to answer questions more correctly after the session.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Tamia Garrett in here because Tamia is the primary author, the research coordinator here. And I'm wondering how, if were you the person who had to kind of pull things in different directions went from the research perspective? Like, yeah, we should probably think about, these things related to the research.
We discussed a lot about the pretest and post-test, and Dr. Jacalino and I were very concerned about the familiarity part of it because we wanted to know the EMS's perspective as a learner. So yes, I was like in collaboration with coming up with how we were going to measure what we were doing.
I think that's such a great combination. So you have somebody who is solely focused on the quality and of the research and able to actually talk back and forth with you, the two author, the primary and final author, just back and forth, and then the whole team about how to make sure that the research integrity is also here, but still make it practical. And so the more practical it is, the more it can be implemented in the real setting, right? So that's the hard part about research in the pre-hospital setting. We all want to, if you sterilize it too much, then it's not scalable and it's not replicable. So and I think it was great that you didn't, go to these great lengths to try and make it this pure, the only way I can say a sterile kind of study. You did it while people were working. You evaluate as best you can. And the same with the pre and post test. You talked about the challenge of whoever was there was going to take these. And so you could have had two different populations, even in the familiarity, the two different populations, but you just said, let's just do it. Let's just measure it, which I really respect that because, and the fact that you put that in the article and said, this was a potential limitation. But then you looked at other, what were the other proxies that you looked at? You looked at something like experience level or something that said, kind of indicated that the two populations were similar
More similar,
enough.
yeah. The experience on the needs assessment and on the kind of final kind of how do you feel about the curriculum, how what are your perspectives were same. So we're thinking we probably have comparable populations. And the fact that we did find differences in spite of the fact that if someone got called away or someone came in late or I think that actually this part I was actually not sure if we would find much difference because of that. But for the most part, I think that we were able to kind of protect their time and to some degree. And then for those people who had to go, we just it was just like you said, just had to make it practical. So.
And I think it's funny because if you would have asked me ahead of time, I would have thought pre and post test stroke might be similar because of so much education around stroke. And I'm not surprised that the seizure group wasn't as much because there is a lot. Again, seizure and stroke are two areas that there's quite a bit of education at the, I mean, from the paramedic, as much as EMS can have, but those two areas because of the evidence behind the treatments and the emphasis on the early treatment. So I think that didn't surprise me, but and also because encephalopathy was lumped in there as well, you maybe didn't see the true impact of the training. So tell me about then, now we're out at, so those were Kirkpatrick levels one and two. So we had the reaction and the familiarity at level one, level two. We've got now the evidence of learning in the short term. Now we're out at level four, which is, does this have any impact on any patient metrics? And we looked at stroke metrics in particular, which I thought was, really smart because that we have them, right? The get with the guidelines or whatever people are gathering from the CARES data. Where are these? Is this part of an data that are already in a registry, the stroke registry?
Yeah, we were one of the, again, great things about this, working on this project was the interprofessional, multi-institution nature of it. So the hospital was very kind to help us find data. It was all anonymized, so it was a little bit hard to, like we didn't say, oh, this patient was seen, and then they had this, TPA time. Again, looking for sort of like you said, a proxy or a signal for any potential impact. And I mean, I know that nothing was significant, but at the same time, there was a little bit of a difference in the median monthly door to needle time, before and after. So, maybe if we had, as Tim mentioned, in the limitations, maybe if we had more, instances or cases or people involved. Or more patients or longer time, there's probably better ways to, in retrospect, there's probably better ways we would design this in the future, to kind of catch those differences.
So what we're looking at here is the median monthly door to needle time, and we're looking at the pre-curriculum phase over in A with the curriculum implementation, and the pre-curriculum phase with post-implementation, and then the pre-curriculum phase with the combined, the overall C. Is that correct? That's I'm just sort of looking at the figure description, and that's for door to needle time, and then this is the thrombolysis. Monthly incidence of thrombolysis. So this would be your tenecteplase. In this case, it was tenecteplase, right? I think
Answers over.
treatment. So, and tell us about this.
Same thing. We were hoping for it to show kind of more of an impact at a community level or at least a local level. Obviously there are a lot of things that go into factors that go into identifying patients who are eligible for thrombolysis. So we saw this sort of as a proxy for identification and timeliness, which again is multifactorial. You have tons of teams. You have an ER team, you have a neurology team, you have the EMS team, you have whatever the patient comes in with, whatever their kind of factors are. So a lot of potential for kind of muddying up the data here, but thought we would just take a look at it. And so, about the same number of cases, but it also is a primary stroke center, so they do, they do see a decent number of cases, as you can see, every month. So
And then the
that's it.
final one, measuring Kirkpatrick level 4, which is again clinical outcomes, is the monthly median incidence of transfer for thrombectomy. So this is your large vessel occlusions. And tell us about this one.
Same thing. We didn't see a lot of change pre and during implementation, but there was a significant difference before and after a number of cases, and sort of a signal for it when you look at pre versus overall after starting. So we saw this as a proxy for identification, like what's an alveolar stroke, because we did go over in one of our sessions about like the Cincinnati score versus like some of the LVO, the VAN score is what we tend to use in our setting. And we went over like cortical signs versus subcortical signs, and so just looking for a signal in the I guess as you mentioned before, community level data on whether there was an increase in identification. Again, multiple factors go into whether a patient gets transferred for thrombectomy, patient level, hospital level, multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary, but just wanted to take a look at it, and we're fortunate to have the data, so.
That's great. Afterwards, now, did you think about maybe other outcomes like, time to status epilepticus termination or, other things that could be measured? I guess, again, this is already part, this is our existing data. So it's nice to have existing data. I don't know if there are other data points that would be existing that you could
None
pull
that
from.
we had offhand with our data that was available. We did look into some of the field data, the dispatch data for a different project, but felt like this was better representation of activity, at least on the stroke side. And again, unfortunately, we didn't have much representation from the other neuro fields. But I think again, future, it's always like what would I do in the future? There's always something more you can do, right? So
Always, always.
and then the as you mentioned, this is the data that's available. The site does participate with the guidelines, so we have the data available to look into things like time to anti-epileptic, which they can give in the field. Things like that would require more granular, data collection, and we also tried to be we wanted to be very respectful of the workflow, which I learned so much from Chief Martin, Chief Woodward about like the workflow and making this practical and understanding what the responsibilities are on duty and how the shifts work and everything. So asking someone to kind of also track what time you gave an anti-epileptic or like things like that would be, I think, a lot, probably doable in some way, shape, or form. And we're definitely kind of letting the wheels turn as we're reflecting on this about kind of ways to kind of capture other neuro fields in a better way.
Yeah, and Chief Martin, did it make you? I know that a lot of times you're an operations kind of person or a training, you're in that practical setting, but you still collect data, and for in the EMS setting, did it make you think, well, there's areas that EMS data could improve, or even asking the crews, did this improve your differentials, your ability to give a good, accurate differential diagnosis?
I know it did improve several differentials by several of the medics, just because I had a lot of feedback from a handful of them during this whole process. It's like, hey, we just talked about this. And then 2 or 3 weeks later, that translated over to the field, into field practice. That, hey, we had a patient that had a large vessel occlusion, something similar. And it worked out exactly how we were taught in our training sessions. Now, with the data gathering part, it is kind of sticky at times, and I wish we would have had a way in the data set that we were grabbing that we could have arbitrarily tossed out. I say arbitrarily, that we could have separated some people that we would not have included TPA treatment, period, no matter what we would have been learned, what we learned or were taught, just either from a time of last known well or things like that, that could have helped differentiate some of the learning objectives with some of the outcomes were. Because I don't see it really as a fault as a program. It's just the nature of the beast that even if we would have caught some of the types of strokes or would have been able to use some of our training that we received, it still didn't change the outcome just because that person was past the time when the outcome could have been, or when that treatment could have been delivered. So, those kind of things I wish we would have looked at a little bit more closely on my side, just to present that data different, because I think it would have had an impact if we were like, hey, we did this, we found this patient, we found this LVO, but we still couldn't because nobody has seen the patient for, 24 hours, those kind of cases.
The granular thing, right? And some of that is qualitative research too. And again, this is it's always a start, right? And I think Tamia Garrett can comment on this. There's never ending questions that come out of a research paper. But this is a great start to more questions. And I think you would put that really well in the discussion section. I do want to ask you about this website learning pilot, because there's some innovative teaching strategies in here that I think educators would really could really gain from here. And one of these, one we mentioned, that having the multimodal, having this case-based focus, the interactive focus, the simulations in between, and then the website learning. Can you tell me about that and who participated in that website learning?
Yeah, and that was another part that we had a vision, and it became more of a pilot, which is fine. You got to start somewhere. We just kind of thought about how, as neurologists, we and feel, again, feel free to chime in, anybody. We learn, the way we learn the exam is being on rounds and having our professors like showing us a patient who has an exam and like, this is why this is more seizure, this is why this is more stroke, or this is neuromuscular, not central or spinal, So kind of that differential you kind of get with like on a case-by-case basis. And while we understand there is a lot of in fact, I mean, I was just looking at the EMS training requirements, was one of the educational experiences for me. There's a lot of stuff in there, but it doesn't, you know, it's sort of like an overview, and I think from what I understand, of course, Chief Martin, you know, chime in, but like I think a lot of people learn kind of case by case, but you don't have like a neurologist who's kind of guiding on the exam. So we, and then at the same time, there is you know, pre-hospital telestroke or telestroke mostly, but I guess it spills into teleneurology and non-stroke. But like there are those that has been implemented, but from a clinical perspective, still kind of limited on patient outcomes anyway. Hopefully we'll get there someday. But we're like, hey, can we make this a way to not only perhaps, you know, help with patient care, but also give this, you know, give these clinicians a sense of like how we work out as assessment and see if that helps them feel again more familiar or helps with our treatment times or anything like that. Unfortunately, it was a little limited logistically. We didn't have all the kind of technical ducks in a row for a little bit, and then one of the things we did learn, which I think we mentioned in the limitations that you mentioned, was that like, you know, it's really hard if they're like 2 minutes away from the hospital. We do not want to be in the way of patient care. So, one thing we're thinking about is how we can do this sort of like for patients who are farther out and kind of look at that in a different way. But it was a joy. Like it was truly a pleasure. And you know, I did almost all of the cases myself, to be honest. But it was kind of cool because I'd be like, hey, I remember you from class. What's up? Okay, let's take care of this patient. And then also kind of being able to bridge that to the whoever was on our telestroke call was also helpful for them. Anecdotally, again, there are only a few cases, but something we're definitely looking into options for the future. So,
Yeah, I want to say we started maybe what two months into the program is
yeah,
when
I was late. Yeah.
how we approached it on the EMS side is we would do a normal assessment so we could hit the stroke alert metrics for the hospital to get them informed. And after we would do our stroke alert to the receiving hospital, every crew had an iPhone that we had purchased prior to the program. And we would get Dr. Hoglino Cole's office number and her hours that she was available. And whenever we had a positive stroke assessment, we would contact, do the stroke alert, and then FaceTime her. Or no, we went through Teladoc. Went through
It was
Teladoc.
Teladoc, yeah, HIPAA compliant one, yeah.
And then she would do a website teaching there in the back of the ambulance. So we'd have the crew walk her through what we had found. And then we would face the phone towards the patient, and she would do a stroke assessment and walk the crew through what she was seeing as well. So it got a little bit more hands-on and direct for the crew, because like I said, it's one thing to be told and versus being shown. So that helped on that one, but it also Dr. Hoglino alluded to it that we did also use that, I think, in one occasion as a telestroke consult, where she was able to call the hospital as well. And it really sped up, like, it was good for training, but it really sped up care for that patient a whole lot. And I wish Christy was online right now, because I think she had a very, very good door to needle time or TPA time on that patient. It was under 10 minutes, if I remember. It was really, really good. Unfortunately, like Dr. Hoglino was saying, it really just was hard to make schedules work. Because, I mean, you have to have the patient that is within time, that the transport time is going to be long enough, that is also in her office hours when she can take that patient. So it was pretty difficult, but the cases it worked out for worked out very, very well.
Oh, that's great. This is we're approaching the top of the hour and the end, and I just there's we could go on, and we didn't even bring Dr. Bill Toon in, but he's been listening in the background, probably just smiling. But the simulation, the conclusions here, simulation improved short-term knowledge of these neurovascular, neuromuscular, and spinal cord and TBI and head injuries. And that there's a potential impact of this multimodal interprofessional curriculum that's very innovative on recognition and triage of thrombectomy, but also the future. I love the terms booster simulations, retention strategies. Bill, did you have anything to add? Dr.
Other than
Toon?
just saying thank you, and I need to still dive into all the supplemental material and everything. What would you like to do next should be the parting comment before she asks you for your last words.
We are definitely looking for opportunities to develop that website teaching, both from a clinical and educational perspective. That was really fun for everybody. So we're definitely looking into kind of ways to build that out, in addition to continuing another iteration of the curriculum. So.
Great. And I'm going to read before I tell you about our next things. The last, this is just beautifully written. So pull this article and read it. And the last part of this, that again, we all shared the common teaching philosophy to encourage learners to understand core concepts underlying clinical decision-making rather than focus solely on technical skills to support the increasing role of EMS clinicians have in public health and complex care. What a sentence. That alone, I think, says so much about what we talk about here. A shared leadership mindset, an intentional approach to curriculum development among EMS leaders, the stroke coordinator, and the neurologist was essential. And that's that I'm reading the last lines of this excellent paper and a great research. And thank you all so much. Congratulations to everyone here. And thank you for joining us. We will have a special live discussion from the PCRF CareStar Equity Research Summit, which is coming up March 8th through 10th. We're going to be talking about women in EMS. We'll have that information. You can go to prehospitalcare.org. But next month, we'll be back with our Education Research Journal Club. We'll be putting out our topic and paper soon, 10 a.m. Pacific, noon Central on March 27th. But before then, Dr. Remley Crowe, Dr. Tony Fernandez will be back, and Dr. Bill Toon will be there too, Monday, March 9th with our Clinical Research Journal Club. A big thank you to everyone, and we will see you next month. Congratulations on your research. We will be following you. I'll be searching Tamia Garrett and Dr. Aquilino, all of you following your research. Hopefully you'll follow up on this, and everyone have a great weekend. Take care.
We hope you have enjoyed and learned from this PCRF Journal Club. Please share it with other interested EMS professionals. An archive of past journal clubs can be found at www.pcrfpodcasts.org. You can also find us on Facebook at PCRF at UCLA and on our website at www.prehospitalcare.org. A special thank you to our sponsor, Limmer Education, providing education tools for success at every stage of your EMS journey.